Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Zulu 5 Oscar by Todd Tucker, narrated by Graham Halstead. Prologue, Y-12. They parked on the far side of Pine Ridge at 2:30 a.m. There were three of them, a defrocked Jesuit priest, an activist nun, and a drifter named Barry who had adopted their brand of militant pacifism. Barry carried their backpack because, at 62 years of age, he was the youngest.
"Are we ready?" asked Tom Corrigan.
"Yes, father," said the sister Anne.
She still called him father, even though he'd been defrocked for more than a decade. The Jesuits had finally rid themselves of him in 1973, while he sat in a jail cell in Indiana after trespassing on Grissom Air Force Base. He hadn't much liked the honorific, even when he'd been entitled to it. But he'd given up arguing with her about it.
"Yes, ready," said Barry, his eyes alive and eager.
He shook the backpack to punctuate the thought. It rattled noisily. It contained everything they needed for their mission. 2 candles, a Bible, heavy bolt cutters, 2 flashlights, 3 cans of spray paint, and 6 baby bottles filled with their own blood. They hiked straight into the woods from their van, heading for the slope of the ridge that they couldn't see but knew was in front of them. It took them 30 minutes to reach the first of 4 fences they would have to breach to penetrate Y-12. Corrigan was inherently skeptical about all things military, and especially about the mythology of the national security system. He'd made a career out of violating perimeters for his protests, waltzing right into supposedly secure facilities and demolishing their illusions of protection while trying to destroy the illusions about their morality. But even so, he thought their chances for success that night in Tennessee slim. They'd never before attempted to violate a facility so secure, nor a facility with such a reputation for fearsome defenses. They'd talked to people who had worked there over the years, people who'd turned their backs on the war machine and come to Corrigan and his allies to help. There were Gatling guns beyond the fences, they learned, manned by private warriors in body armor with orders to shoot to kill. Corrigan believed in God, and he believed God wanted him to do this, even if it meant dying. But he had no desire to watch Sister Anne cut down by machine guns. He stepped aside so Barry could cut through the wire. The fence was just 6 feet high. Decades before, he would have just climbed it, but they were all too old now. They'd have to cut through it even if that increased their chances of being caught. In looking it over, however, Corrigan wasn't too worried. The fence was rusty, poorly maintained, and didn't look like it was electrified or monitored in any way. Tree branches grew through it, and its yellow "No Trespassing" sign was faded. In smaller letters, the sign also threatened a $100,000 fine. Corrigan tapped it.
"If they can find that much money in my bank account, they're welcome to it."
Barry chuckled politely as he cut through the links. He peeled back a section and let Corrigan and Sister Anne through. He closed the fence behind them and fastened it with twine, making it look whole, at least from a distance, should some random patrol come through the woods and shine a flashlight upon it. They hiked on. They had taped the heads of their flashlights so that just a narrow band of light came through, just enough to illuminate the patch of woods in front of them. It was July in Tennessee, and it was still hot, even in the middle of the night. Corrigan felt himself sweating through his shirt. The smell of pines made him think of hikes he and his brother had made as kids back in Minnesota, long before the seminary, before Vietnam, before jail cells too numerous to count. He was getting tired. He cursed his age, not for the first time, making it hard to do what had to be done. Sister Anne seemed to be flagging, too. There weren't many young people to take his place. There were no new hippies, and the few that were left were all old like him. The hippies had mostly become investment bankers and lawyers anyway. Only the old religious people had been able to maintain their fervor through all these years. Up the ridge, almost 1,000 feet. At the top, they were all exhausted, even Barry. They stopped to take it in. The halogen-lit atomic city below them, the facility known as Y-12.
Y-12, along with the nearby city of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, had been created as part of the Manhattan Project during World War II. It was born in secret in 1943, secret to even the thousands of people who worked there. The engineering of an atomic weapon was never that complicated. The hard part, from the beginning, was the manufacturing, the creation of magical substances like uranium-235 in quantity, the nearly impossible process of separating out that precious isotope from the chemically identical but relatively useless uranium ore that anyone could mine from the ground. Several nations had rudimentary plans for an atomic bomb on the books as the war dragged on, but only the United States, with its vast wealth and industrial might, could build a facility like Oak Ridge, an entire city devoted to this kind of alchemy. Y-12 remained the sole source of the nation's weapons-grade uranium-235, as well as the nation's uranium warehouse. While everything associated with the site was tightly classified, numerous reports had it that about 400 tons of uranium-235 were inside, enough for 10,000 bombs. It was the throbbing, beating heart of the American nuclear arsenal, and Corrigan had no doubt, as he looked down from the ridge at the massive buildings bathed in floodlights, that he was staring into the face of genuine evil. "Ready?" he said. Sister Anne wiped the sweat from her face with a hanky and nodded. Barry stood up and started marching down the hill. At the bottom of the ridge, the trees had been cleared. It made for easier walking, but it also made them far more exposed. They approached the second of four fences that guarded the facility. Unlike the rusty perimeter fence that they had already cut through, these fences were tall, about 8 feet, and topped with concertina wire. They appeared well-maintained. Cameras in sturdy-looking housings were perched atop high poles, pointing right at them, and wires of various kinds snaked throughout the fence links. The warning signs were in better shape, too, and promised that deadly force was authorized within. Corrigan approached the fence first and looked closely at one of the wires. "I think that's fiber optic," he said. "Cut it?" said Barry. Corrigan nodded. He was certain that alarms would scream the minute the bolt cutters bit into the wire. He would be fine with that. He hoped that the sirens wouldn't be followed by the chugging of machine guns. He moved to stand in front of Sister Anne. Barry quickly cut through a series of links and the associated wires. Nothing happened. They crossed a moat of white rocks to another fence. This fence had even more electronics hooked up to it, what Corrigan assumed were motion sensors. Barry made quick work of it, too, and again, nothing happened. No sirens wailed, no jeeps raced toward them. Now they reached the final fence, the innermost, and Corrigan's heart began pounding. "We're going to make it," he thought. He began rapidly thinking about what they wanted to do inside, what the priorities were, because he didn't know how much time they would have. Barry cut through the last fence, and they climbed through. They were inside. An old priest, an old nun, and a drifter had just penetrated the most secure nuclear weapons facility in the world. They walked quickly, with purpose, trying to look like they belonged there to anyone that might view them on security cameras. Corrigan was still shocked that there were no vehicles racing to intercept them, though he was certain they would be there soon. They reached the wall of their target, the highly enriched uranium materials facility, both a factory and a warehouse for all the nation's weapons-grade uranium. Soon they were up against the thick concrete wall. Still, there was no guard to stop them. Barry threw down his backpack, jittery with excitement. "The bottles," Corrigan said. Barry rooted around in the back until he found them, handed out 2 bottles to each. It was important to start with the blood. The blood had to be spilled. It was the central part of the protest. It was the most important step symbolically, of course, meant to draw people's attention to the fact that they were making weapons of mass destruction, weapons that were designed to spill massive, unimaginable quantities of human blood. This was a concept that the war machine carefully hid from its laborers, and spilling the bright red blood upon the dry, gray concrete of the military-industrial complex always, even now, shocked people and drew a crowd. The employees of the plant, he knew, would seek it out for weeks, stare at the blood, a dark stain that nature had made very difficult to remove. Corrigan had first seen the power of it over 2 decades before, when he broke into a draft office in Baltimore in 1967 and poured a bottle of his own blood atop a wire basket filled with draft records. He'd still been a priest then, and he remembered wistfully what kind of access the priestly collar gave him in a Catholic city like Baltimore. No one questioned him as he walked right into the office. Even the cops, when they arrested him, were sweetly deferential. "Right here, Father, and have a seat, Father, at the police station. Every last one of them educated in Baltimore's Jesuit schools." It was one of the things he missed the most about being a priest, the automatic respect, deference that was really respect for the church. He still kept his priestly vestments hanging in his closet for some reason, and wondered about his occasional nostalgia for the priesthood. Maybe it was nostalgia for that era. Since the Baltimore draft office action, then he'd poured his blood on the tires of B-52 bombers in Maryland, missile reentry vehicles at a GE plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and a Dow chemical factory in Michigan. Each of those actions had been followed by steadily increasing jail time, almost 10 years if you added it all together. As his jail sentences increased, the attention of the public and the press steadily waned. The three invaders stood and held the bottles in front of them.
"Bless us, Holy Father," said Corrigan, "and forgive these people, for they know not what they do."
He turned and poured his blood against the side of the building. He took the second bottle and did the same, as Sister Anne and Barry followed. Soon the corner of the facility was covered in the thick, dark blood of the old protesters. Still, no one had tried to stop them. They tossed the empty bottles to the ground, and Barry pulled out the hammers from his pack so they could begin the next symbolic stage of the protest. There were 2 large hammers, each with words scrawled on its wooden grip. "Transform now," and Isaiah 2:4. Barry and Corrigan beat on the corner of the building, another important metaphorical step in all their operations, beating swords into plowshares, some small act of destruction. Pebbles of concrete fell at their feet, followed by large chunks. A few feet away from them, Sister Anne spray-painted on a wall, "Repent, God's kingdom is at hand." Soon, a small pile of concrete chips lay at his feet. Corrigan stopped to wipe his brow and rest his arm. Barry and Anne looked up at him. They had never before attempted an operation on a facility so tightly guarded, and they had never before had so much time.
"What happens if you throw a protest and nobody comes?" asked Corrigan.
They all laughed. They heard a noise, a car approaching at last. Headlights swung across a far building as it turned toward them.
"Finally," said Corrigan.
"Come," he said, holding out his hands. They formed a circle and began chanting the Lord's Prayer. They finished as the security car rolled up and put their hands in the air. The lone security guard, an older man with kind eyes and a thick gray mustache, rolled down his window. He looked them over slowly before speaking.
"What are you doing here?"
"The Lord sent us here," said Barry.
The graffiti caught his eye, and Corrigan could see it dawning on the guard what they were. Protesters. Peace nuts, not terrorists or spies. He was glad to see the guard perceive it so quickly. It made it less likely that they would be shot. The guard started to speak again, but his radio crackled to life. He picked up his microphone and answered.
"Three protesters," he said. "They've breached our system, written graffiti all over the walls."
The radio crackled something in response, skepticism.
"Yes," he said. "I need backup."
He hung up the mic and got out of his car.
"Stay right where you are," he said.
But he didn't reach for his gun. Corrigan breathed deeply. The most dangerous moments were always those first moments after detection, when they might still be mistaken for criminals or terrorists. But the guard radiated competence and experience. They would be safe. Sister Anne started singing "This Little Light of Mine," and Corrigan and Barry joined in. They were still singing when the second vehicle rolled up, and then a third, all filled with serious-looking guards with M16s. Corrigan looked to see if Sister Anne or Barry were afraid. Corrigan was not. He'd been through it all before. They were charged with an array of crimes, including sabotage. That was a first for Corrigan, and sabotage was a federal charge that carried with it the potential for a 30-year sentence. Despite the severity of the crimes, the judge perceived them to be harmless enough for bail, which was quickly fronted by a federation of religious orders and pacifist organizations. Many of those organizations invited Corrigan to speak in the weeks following the arraignment, rapt groups of a dozen or so aging hippies in tie-dye and true believers with giant wooden crosses around their necks. It was a far cry from the 60s when he used to speak to thousands of impassioned students about Vietnam, back when he could still wear a priest's collar and be quoted in Time magazine. He had the honor of being followed around by men under direct orders from J. Edgar Hoover himself, obsessed as always with finding some kind of sexual deviance in his prey, a violation of his vow of celibacy. Not for the last time, Corrigan frustrated Hoover's efforts. Corrigan adhered to his vows of celibacy for the same reasons that an older generation of priests always had, because physical desire was displaced by the pure fervor with which he believed in his religious mission, and because he had a genuine fear of hell. The same sense of mission had kept him poor and celibate long after the Jesuits had disowned him. Even as he stared down a prison sentence that might see him die in a federal cell, the press barely paid attention. When the Y-12 operation was written about, it was usually a story about the lax security, not about any moral questions that Corrigan and his group had tried to raise. Many things enraged Corrigan about Y-12, and he was a man who'd learned how to hone his anger into a precision weapon. Corrigan would learn in the days after his arrest that only one man was punished at Y-12 for what had happened, not the private company that was paid $100 million a year to run security, not the manager who had allowed a security camera near them to malfunction for over 6 months, not the supervisors who had tolerated over 2,000 false alarms a day, most caused by wildlife, until they'd all reached the point where nobody paid any attention at all. The only man punished for the sins of Y-12 was the old security guard with the thick mustache. 2 years short of retirement, he was singled out for what they said was a casual response to the intrusion. Apparently, they thought he should have drawn his gun and shot them all down. Corrigan puttered around his small apartment in the days after the arrest, prohibited from leaving the state. He worried that God was done with him, that his mode of protest had become ineffective in this modern age. He decided he would pray and fast until the Lord gave him an answer. After 3 days, he was dizzy with hunger and almost ready to give up when a bang at the door startled him to his feet. Resting on his welcome mat was a package, too big for his mailbox, dropped at his doorstep by a hurried mailman. He stopped to pick it up, brought it back into his apartment. He tore open the cardboard to reveal a large, glossy book. "What Are We Fighting For? A Photographic History of the Anti-War Movement." A small note card fell out of it as he opened it. "Dear Mr. Corrigan, thanks so much for allowing me to interview you, and thank you for your ongoing efforts in the name of a more peaceful world. Sincerely, Don Mara." Corrigan had zero memory of ever speaking to Don Mara. As he flipped through the book, however, the images were deeply familiar to him. They were glossy, artistic images on large pages, with scant paragraphs describing them. Tear gas in Chicago, uniformed National Guardsmen at Kent State, the burning of draft cards, the shattered Vietnam veterans in Washington. As Corrigan expected, there was an air of reverence in the book that annoyed him. Self-congratulation. "We stopped a war." The benediction of all the usual heroes. Tom Hayden, even then too dour and filled with self-importance. Mario Savio, still ferociously intense. Other carefully curated images of Joan Baez, Jane Fonda, and Abby Hoffman. Corrigan, aware that he was giving in to his own sinful pride, tried to find anywhere in the book that mentioned him. He looked in the table of contents and found there was a chapter devoted to religious pacifism. He turned to that page. The image that opened that chapter, splashed across two pages, took his breath away. It wasn't the carefully crafted anger of the student protesters that filled the rest of the book. This photograph, raw, genuine, and horrifying, and sacramental, he thought. Corrigan remembered vividly when it had happened, in 1963, how it had electrified the movement even as it forced them all to answer questions about their own commitment to peace and to the church. The image had lost none of its power. And with that, Corrigan realized that God was, at last, showing him the way. After saying a brief prayer of thanks, he dug an old anti-nuclear pamphlet out of his desk. It contained a map of the United States, with a red dot showing every facility that housed nuclear weapons. The size of the red dot indicated the size of the facility, the number of weapons. The map was old and had been designed as a propaganda piece. The red dots spread across the United States like a disease. Corrigan had no idea how accurate it was, but he searched the map for a large red dot that was far away from him, far from the authorities that would soon be searching for him. He soon chose his target. The next day, Corrigan packed up a few belongings in a battered duffel bag. One of these possessions was a fake driver's license with the name Ron Dixon on it, and a MasterCard in the same name with a $5,000 limit. He went to a travel agency in the mall and bought a plane ticket to SeaTac Airport and reserved a rental car. Both the credit card and the fake identification worked perfectly. It wasn't the first time he had gone underground, but God willing, it would be the last. Chapter 1 Machinist's Mate First Class Halloran had orders to the USS Maine, a Trident submarine based in Naval Submarine Base Bangor, Washington. While the Maine was in port, actually in the center of the Delta Pier's dry dock, there had been a problem with his medical jacket during his transfer. It got flagged by some medial officer somewhere, who said that Halloran couldn't report to the boat until he got his wisdom teeth yanked. Even in dry dock, it didn't matter. The medical jacket of a man on any seagoing command had to be pristine. Halloran made the appointment with the base dentist, but the earliest he could get in for the procedure was 5 days. The start of his next sea tour was thus delayed. Until then, he was told to report to Squadron 17 headquarters, where he would be stashed for temporary duty. He was shown to a suite of 3 offices, which contained 2 bare and battered metal desks, a coffee maker, a phone that appeared inoperative, and 3 other enlisted men like him who were temporarily without a home. He was told to report each morning at 8 a.m., see if there was anything to do, which there never was, and then, it seemed, he would be able to sneak off and enjoy the day. They called it Indian Liberty. It was only for the brave. The 3 other stashed petty officers grinned at him conspiratorially as he entered on that first day, a smile that said 2 things. 1, we've got a good deal here. And 2, don't screw it up for the rest of us. On that first morning, he waited until he was the last man to leave, which only took 2 hours. One of the other stashed petty officers, a third-class sonar man with orders to the Pennsylvania, invited him to play basketball. Another, a first-class ET destined for the Alabama, invited him to play golf. "I was on the Alabama," said Halloran to him. "My first sea tour." "Were you on there when the shit hit the fan?" "I was," said Halloran, and they discussed it briefly, but the man had a tea time to keep, and they promised to catch up in more depth the next morning. Halloran went to the exchange and bought a few random uniform items he needed, a brass belt buckle, an extra set of silver dolphins, and a new pair of steel-toed boots. He had lunch at the base McDonald's, called the movers 3 times to ask if his small cargo of personal goods had made it yet from San Diego. He got a haircut. He considered going for a run, but decided against it. He was bored, but not that bored. The next morning, Halloran showed up at 7:30, waited outside the locked office door until 7:55, starting to vaguely worry that he was standing at the wrong door, despite writing down the room number on the small green pad that he kept in the back pocket of his dress whites. The ET with orders to the Alabama showed up, reassuring him that he was in the right place. They were all present by 8. When a lieutenant with about 1 sea tour's worth of ribbons on his chest showed up with a ring of keys and let them in. As they filed in, he said something alarming.
"The duty officer is on his way. He's got something for you."
When he left and his black service Oxfords had clicked a safe distance down the passageway, the sonar man said, "Well, shit." They all sighed heavily. A few minutes later, he was there, with the two silver bars of a lieutenant on his collar, but more ribbons than a normal O3, one of which was the solid maroon of the Good Conduct ribbon, given only to enlisted men. So, he was prior enlisted. He scowled slightly as he looked them over, as if he was on to them, aware of the sweet deal they'd been getting, and was inclined to restore order to the universe by giving them some shitty assignment to complete. He took a sheet of paper out of a folder he was carrying, scanned it briefly, and addressed the men.
"I'm Lieutenant Gray," he said, "and I need a volunteer."
"I'll do it," said Halloran, immediately, standing up. Everyone, including the lieutenant, seemed shocked.
"Okay," he said. "Follow me."
Halloran could feel relief descend on the room behind him as he departed. He followed Lieutenant Gray to his cube at the end of a passageway which contained four desks and a bulky black iron safe that looked like it would outlast the drab Squadron 17 headquarters by a century or so. He sat down and pointed at a chair for Halloran.
"Do you know what a Zulu 5 Oscar is?"
"Yes, sir," said Halloran. "A security drill. An unauthorized person tries to gain access to a submarine."
"That's right. You ever stand topside watch?"
"Yes, sir, on the Alabama, many times."
"You were on the Alabama?"
He started to ask the question that Halloran always got asked about his time on that boat, but stopped himself, afraid of looking impressed.
"You ever let a Zulu 5 Oscar through?"
"No, sir. I don't think anyone ever tried on my watch. They warned us about the drill, but they didn't seem to ever run them much."
The lieutenant nodded.
"Yeah, they stopped for a while. These drills led to a lot of bad feelings. But the general notion now is that topside security has gotten lax. Additionally, the current security situation merits it. We have to be more diligent than ever. Peace protesters and whatnot. Crazy people with Bibles and bottles of blood."
"Yes, sir."
Halloran had no idea what the lieutenant was talking about.
"We've been running the drills with officers, but they haven't been getting through. I've tried a few myself. My theory is that the topside watches are just on better behavior in general when a strange officer comes around.
And maybe officers are just bad liars."
"That's certainly not it," said Lieutenant Gray. "So, you want to try it?"
"Sir?"
"Be a Zulu 5 Oscar. Bluff your way onto these boats."
"Yes, sir, absolutely."
The lieutenant again seemed befuddled by Halloran's enthusiasm. Perhaps it was a vestige of his own enlisted days, when every sailor learned at some point that Navy actually stood for Never Again Volunteer Yourself.
"Okay," he said. "Here are the ground rules. Weapons not allowed, obviously. You can't use force or threats of force. You can't pretend to be an officer. Can only use normal access points, the LETs and hatches. If you obtain any secret material or anything above secret, you've got to turn it in to the ship's duty officer. That, by the way, would be considered a very successful Zulu 5 Oscar."
"Aye, sir."
"Here's a box of fake badges," he said, reaching behind Halloran and tapping an old cardboard box. "All are obvious fakes. Pictures that aren't you, expired dates, etc. Anybody that lets you through with one of these is screwing up, which means you have done your job."
"Aye, sir."
"Here's your letter," he said, handing him a document on Squadron 17 letterhead, signed by the Commodore himself. It was headlined in caps, "Authorization to conduct security inspections." "Show this to the ship's duty officer when you find him, or he finds you. Anticipate him being very pissed off."
"Aye, sir."
"Then come back and report to me how it goes. Any questions?"
"Yes, sir. What boats are in port right now?"
The lieutenant thought it over.
"Three, I think. Henry M. Jackson, Kentucky, and the Maine in dry dock. Why?"
"Just curious, sir," said Halloran.
He wouldn't do the Maine until last. He wanted to get a feel for the job before he showed himself to his future shipmates. Depending on how things went on the other two boats, he might try to be especially effective on the Maine, or especially ineffective. He decided to start with the Henry M. Jackson. He'd lost a girlfriend once to a nuke from that boat,
so it seemed like a logical place to start.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?